Go off to work.
I was next, a woman said to me. You gotta get to the rear of the line.
Chill, I told her. I'm wanted for murder and I'm not in a good mood. Here's the thing, Diggory said to me. I know it's not a big deal to go get bonded out again, but it's gonna cost me more money and I don't have it. I had to buy winter coats for the kids and rats for the snake. If you let me finish my tax business, I'll come with you. I'll have money from the taxes. Tell you what, you cut me some slack here and I'll do your taxes, no charge.
How much longer do you need?
2 weeks.
I really could use some help with my taxes.
Just put your pertinent information in a shoebox and bring it all to me. I'll be able to fit you in next Monday. I'll be at Cluck in a Bucket on Hamilton Avenue between 10 and 12 at night. What was that about?
Morelli asked when I got back to the SUV. Simon Diggory doing taxes. He said he needed the money to buy rats for the snake, so I let him go.
That's my girl,
Morelli said. He flipped a bagel back to Bob and took us home. I'd gotten bagels, donuts, cream cheese, milk, orange juice bread, and a jar of peanut butter. Dickie chose a bagel and loaded it up with cream cheese. Morelli and I ate donuts.
Talk while you eat, Morelli said to Dickie. You went into business with Smullen Gorevitch and Pediak. Then what?
It was all looking good. We bought the building, and then we were doing well, so we made some other real estate investments. Pediak and Gorevitch both had home offices, and I only saw them at the off-site Monday meetings. Fine by me. I always thought Pediak was a little creepy. He has this quiet way of talking, choosing his words as if English is his second language. And there's something about his eyes, like light goes in but doesn't come out. And Smullen had ties to South America, so I saw him sporadically. It was a little like having my own firm. I had my own clients and my own staff. There were four names on the stationery, but I was usually the only partner in the building.
Morelli refilled his coffee and topped off my coffee and Dickie's.
What went wrong?
It was Ziggy Zabar, the accountant. He figured out what was really going on, and he wanted to get paid off.
And what was really going on? Morelli asked.
It's actually very clever, Dickie said. They were using the law firm to launder money. Pediak was a military guy until he got booted out for something. Probably insanity. Anyway, he was a supply officer, worked in a depot and had access to all the munitions. And he saw a way to tap into these depots all across the country and move munitions out of the depots into his private warehouse.
The warehouse on Stark Street?
Yes. Next comes Peter Smullen. Smullen is married to a woman from a cartel family. Smullen has contacts all over South America. These contacts have dope, but need guns. So Smullen takes the dope, and Pediak delivers the guns. The last piece to the puzzle is Gorevitch. Gorevitch is the drug dealer. He gets the stuff from Smullen and packages it up and distributes it. Now comes a good part. The money Gorevitch takes in for drug sales is recorded as payment for legal services. It gets deposited in the firm's account and is sanitized.
Morelli took a second donut.
So Pediak smuggles guns off government property, stores them in your warehouse, and then ships them off to South America. The cartel pays for the guns with drugs. The drugs get shipped to Trenton, probably to the warehouse, where they're packaged and sold to local dealers, and the dealers pay for the dope in billable hours.
Yep,
Dickie said.
Genius, right?
Not exactly. Zabar figured it out.
Well, it was good in theory, Dickie said. It would make a good movie.
Where do you fit in all this?
I was the token real lawyer in the firm. I was supposed to give them some legitimacy. The only reason I know anything is because Smullen made a phone call from his office and I happened to be in the hall. He was on speakerphone talking to Pediak, and they were making plans to pull all the money out of the firm and disappear. Pediak said there was no rush. He said Zabar was taken care of and wasn't going to make any more problems. This was Tuesday morning, after the Monday partners meeting that Zabar was supposed to attend. Smullen said if Zabar could figure it out, there were others in the accounting firm that could do the same thing. Pediak agreed, but said they had to give Gorevitch 2 weeks to transact business.
Bob came in and sat at Morelli's feet.
You ate your bagel in the car, Morelli said to Bob. You'll get fat if you eat another bagel.
Bob heaved himself to his feet and padded back to the living room.
Was this when you cleaned out the Smith Barney account?
Morelli asked.
Not right away. I didn't know what to make of it. My worst fear had always been that one of Gorevitch's drug dealers would walk in and shoot up the office. I knew our client list was scary. A conspiracy never occurred to me.
You must have known they were all from Sheepshead.
Everyone has a circle of professionals they tap into when the need arises.
They bought their degrees on the internet, I said to Dickie.
At the time, I didn't care. I didn't have the resources to make a success on my own, so I was willing to do some denial to get a partnership.
Why didn't you go to the police when they killed Ziggy Zabar?
I didn't know they killed Zabar. Pediak said he took care of him. That could have meant anything. Later in the week, the police came asking if Zabar had attended the meeting, but even then he was just missing. Pediak could have paid him off and Zabar could have gone to Rio. Anyway, have you seen Pediak? He's not a guy you could walk up to and ask if he killed your accountant.
Dickie pushed back in his chair.
You need a television in here. How can you have a kitchen without a television?
I manage, Morelli said. So what I'm supposed to believe is that you heard a phone conversation suggesting your partners were going to take your money and run, and you didn't do anything?
I didn't confront them, if that's what you mean. These are guys who have professional hitmen on their client list. I represent Norman Walecki. I backed out of the hall without making a sound, and when the building emptied out for the night, I went through all the financial records, and I found out how much money we had at Smith Barney. I knew from the phone conversation that something illegal had gone down, but I couldn't figure out what it was. I thought it was probably something like tax evasion. If it was tax evasion, I knew I was fucked. I signed the returns just like everybody else. What was pissing me off was that they were going to take the money and leave me behind to take the fall. I was sitting on this information, waiting for someone to come to me, and no one did. So Friday afternoon, I went to Joyce's house so no one would hear me, and I cleaned out the Smith Barney account. It was easy. All four of us have our own password to access the account. My plan was to wait for the Monday meeting. If they didn't say anything to me at the Monday meeting, I was going to leave the country and enjoy my $40 million. Screw Smolin, Gorbich, and Pediak. My mistake was that I didn't leave soon enough. Smolin found out about the withdrawal and sent the goon patrol to my house Monday night.
You still could have fled, I said to him. Why'd you hang around?
To begin with, I didn't have a passport. It was in my house, and my house was filled with cops. And then when I went back to my house, my passport was missing. I know there are ways to get a fake passport, but I'm not James Bond. I don't know how to go about getting a fake passport, and the thought of using it scares the crap out of me. I get nervous when I have to take my shoes off at the airport. I'm innocent, and I feel guilty. What am I going to do when I'm actually guilty? So, I put myself in a cheap motel in Bordentown until I could come up with a plan. I'm not talking to anyone, not even Joyce. Okay, maybe phone sex, but that was it. And then I'm watching television, and the local news comes on, and they're talking about how Zabar, the accountant, washed up on the banks of the Delaware. Now I know Pediak killed Zabar. This is serious shit. This isn't just income tax evasion. This is also murder. Time to get out of Dodge, I tell myself. If I can't go to an island and lose myself, I can at least go to Scottsdale. Unfortunately, it turns out I can't get to the money. Now I'm really in a bind. I have no more cash in my pocket, and I'm afraid to use a credit card and have it traced. I get to thinking about the warehouse and the apartment building the firm owns, and I wonder if I can hang out there for just a couple days until I can locate the money. I go to the apartment building, and it's in use. Full. No empty apartments. Then I go to the warehouse, and I see Gorbich in the parking lot talking to Eddie Aurelio. Two of Aurelio's soldiers are standing watch at Parade Rest by Aurelio's Lincoln. It's like a scene out of The Godfather. I don't know a whole lot about the Trenton drug scene, but I know Aurelio is big-time mob. I drove past the warehouse and got on Route 1 and kept going until Princeton. I stopped at a Starbucks and tried to get my heart rate down over a latte. Decaf. I didn't know what the hell was going on, but I was running out of options until I could get the money. So I called the police and told them about Gorbich and Aurelio and Gorbich's client list and about Smullen and Pediak taking care of Zabar, the accountant. I told them I'd testify to all this, but they had to put me someplace safe. And I told them I only trusted Morelli. So here I am.
Why Morelli?
Because you have the key, Morelli said to me. He needed to be close to the key. He knew we were seeing each other, and he thought he might catch some stray information. He's been sitting here waiting for another opportunity to retrieve the key. What he didn't realize was that Pediak was staking out your apartment for entirely different reasons.
Pediak is doing cleanup,
Dickie said.
He's getting rid of anyone who looks like a threat. At least that's the way he tells it. After spending some very scary time with him, my feeling is he's gone gonzo. I think Stephanie popped up on his radar screen, and he just wanted to enjoy the experience of taking his flamethrower to her.
And you gave him more reason, didn't you? Morelli said.
He hit me. First that range man gorilla attacked me in the apartment, and then I got kidnapped on the way out of the building. It was traumatic. I was handcuffed, and they rammed me down onto the floor of the car so I couldn't see anything. And then when they dragged me out, I still didn't know where we were. I only knew I was in a two-car garage. No windows, no other cars. There was just the light from the garage door opener. Pediak was there with his spooky eyes. He didn't say anything to me. I still had my hands locked behind my back, and he hit me in the face. Just like that. Bam! What the fuck was that? I said to him.
That was to let you know I'm serious, he said.
Then he asked me where the $40 million was, and I said I didn't know. So he hit me again, except that time it wasn't in the face, and I decided to tell him whatever he wanted to know.
You told him Stephanie had the key.
I told you, he hit me.
I saw Morelli's eyes turn black, and I felt the air pressure change in the room. I stepped between Morelli and Dickie and put a hand to Morelli's chest. You don't want to kill him, I said to Morelli.
Get out of my way.
This is complicated enough, and we might need him for something. And you'd have to go before a review board if you kill him or seriously maim him.
I don't get it, Dickie said to Morelli. What's the big deal here? He already wanted to kill her. It's not like he could kill her twice. Man, you two are a pair. You have anger management issues. I hope you're not planning on reproducing. Hate to see a kid with her hair anyway.
I turned to Dickie. What's wrong with my hair?
It's always a mess. You should get Joyce to help you with it. She has great hair. If you'd been more like Joyce, things might have worked out differently.
After that, things happened pretty fast. And when Morelli pulled me off Dickie, his nose was bleeding again. Someone had knocked Dickie off his chair and gone after him like Wild Woman. I guess that was me. Morelli had me at the waist with my feet 2 inches off the floor, and I could feel him laughing against me.
I don't know why I always feel like I have to take care of you, Morelli said. You do such a good job of it all by yourself.
There was blood splattered across the floor, soaking into Dickie's shirt. Crap, I said. Am I responsible for all that blood?
No, he cracked his nose on the table when he panicked and tried to get away from you. If I put you down, do you promise not to go after him again?
Forever?
No, just in the next 10 minutes.
Sure. Morelli got some ice out of the freezer, wrapped it in a towel, and handed it to Dickie.
Do you suppose you could try being a little less obnoxious?
What'd I do? I'm sitting here minding my own business trying to be cooperative. Talk to Bitchzilla over there.
I looked at my watch. 9 minutes, I said to Morelli.
I've got blood all over my shirt, Dickie said.
Morelli mopped the blood up off the floor with some wadded paper towels.
First of all, it's my shirt, and second, it's still the cleanest shirt we've got until we do laundry.
Well, for cripes sakes, do the laundry, Dickie said.
I don't have a washer or dryer, and I can't leave you in the house alone.
I can take the laundry to my mom's house, I said. Gather it up for me.
I want to know the rest of the story first, Morelli said.
Dickie had his head tipped back with the ice pack over his nose.
I'm not talking anymore. I have a headache.
Morelli went to the powder room and got a bottle of Advil.
From what I've heard so far, you didn't know a whole lot about the drugs for arms business. How'd you find out about all that?
Pediak told me after he hit me. He's on a big nutso ego trip. Had to tell me all the details of his master plan. Even demonstrated his flamethrower. Almost burned the fucking garage down. I gotta admit, the flamethrower is pretty cool. He says he sells a lot of them to the South American drug lords. Apparently scares the bejesus out of the locals. And I have to tell you, I almost messed myself at the thought of getting it turned on me.
Why didn't he turn it on you?
I imagine he wanted to make sure I was telling the truth about the key. I got stun gunned, and I guess injected with something. And next thing, I was back here.
And the key? Morelli asked.
It's actually a key card. It allows a cardholder to access a high security account in Holland from a satellite location here in the States. I have the account numbers memorized and a second set in a safety deposit box. But they weren't any good without the card. Without the card, I have to go to Holland to appear in person and pass a retinal and fingerprint scan, not an option without a passport.
Stephanie seems like an odd choice for the key keeper.
I didn't choose her. She took the key with her when she left my office. The key's in the clock. I wasn't too worried about it because I knew she'd take care of the clock. I figured in some ways it was probably safer than if I'd left it at the office.
What clock? Morelli asked.
Her Aunt Tootsie gave us a desk clock as a wedding present. I was using it in my office, and Sticky Fingers took it on her way out. I went to her apartment twice to look for it and couldn't find it. It's not here either, so I'm assuming it's at her parents' house.
I'd entirely forgotten about the clock. I was mentally scrambling, tracing backwards. When did I last see the clock? It was in my bag. Then I stopped at the food store, put the bags in the back of the car, put the clock with the bags, took the bags into the house. Could I have left the clock in the car? I couldn't remember bringing the clock into my apartment.
You're looking pale,
Morelli said.
Like all the blood just drained out of your face. You're not going to faint, are you?
I think I left the clock in the car.
What car?
The Crown Vic.
Where is it now?
Morelli asked. I don't know. It broke down on Route 206, and Ranger had one of his men take care of it.
Dickie took the ice pack off his face.
You lost Aunt Tootsie's clock?
It's not your money anyway, Morelli said to Dickie. It's drug money. It belongs to the government. It'll be confiscated.
I called Ranger and asked him about the Crown Vic. He called back 3 minutes later.
Binky had it towed to the salvage yard, Ranger said.
Which one?
Rizzoli's off Stark.
How's Tank?
Tank's good. He was discharged this morning. Anything I need to know?
Yes, but it's too complicated to tell you on the phone. I'll be around later. Did you feed Rex breakfast and give him fresh water?
That's part of Ella's job description.
I flipped my phone closed. It's at Rizzoli's. Dickie's eyes got wide.
The junkyard? My God, they'll compress it to the size of a lunchbox.
I'll call it in, Morelli said. They'll send someone out to locate the car.
What about me? Dickie said. Do I stay here?
Your status hasn't changed, Morelli said. Until I hear otherwise, you're in protective custody.
Get me your laundry basket, I said to Morelli. I need clean clothes. I think I'm starting to mold.
Chapter 18.
Grandma Mazur had Blackie under her arm when she opened the door. What are you doing with Blackie? I asked her.
I've been trying to find just the right place to set him out. I want him to look natural.
At the risk of being unkind, Blackie would need to be in Frankenstein's lab to look natural. I have Morelli's laundry. I thought I'd throw it in the washer and then I have to get back to Morelli, I told Grandma.
Blackie and me will take care of it for you. We haven't got anything better to do.
I left the laundry with Grandma and ran back to Morelli's SUV. I thought maybe Lula was right, and I didn't do much for Morelli. It wouldn't kill me to pitch in and clean his house today. It was only a matter of time before my life was back to normal, although I was beginning to think weird might be normal for me. The police would get the car and the clock and the money. They'd find Pediac and lock him up, and I wasn't sure what would happen to Dickie. Morelli's house was less than a quarter of a mile from my parents' house. I drove 2 blocks and was T-boned by a Hummer coming out of an alley that ran behind a row of houses. The impact rammed me into a parked car and left me breathless. Before I had a chance to collect myself, my door was wrenched open and I was yanked from behind the wheel. It was Dave, with a broken nose, bandaged finger, and brace on his knee.
Huh, Dave said, jamming the barrel of a gun into my ribs. We figured you'd come to see your mom. We've been waiting for you.
I recognized the garage from Dickie's description. No windows, room for 2 cars, large charred area where Pediac had demonstrated the flamethrower.
We finally meet, Pediac said. I hope you brought the key.
Here's the thing about the key. I don't have it.
Wrong answer. That's not at all what I wanted to hear. That answer's making me angry.
Yes, but I know where it is.
Why can nothing ever be simple?
Pediac asked, sounding a lot like my mother. As Dickie probably told you, I didn't realize I had the key. He hid the key in a clock. I took the clock. I didn't know there was a key in it. I left the clock in the trunk of a car, and the car was towed to a salvage yard.
Dickie didn't tell me any of this.
What did he tell you?
He told me you had the key.
Yes, I had the key, but technically I don't have the key anymore.
Well, at least I can have the pleasure of killing you, Pediac said.
You're not listening to me. I know where the key is. We just have to go get it. But here's the thing.
I knew there would be another thing, Pediac said.
You have to promise not to kill me. And I want a reward, a finder's fee.
And if I don't agree?
I won't help you find the key. I mean, what's the incentive to finding the key if you're going to kill me no matter what?
How much of a reward do you want?
$10,000.
Five.
Okay, 5. I didn't for a minute think Pediac wouldn't kill me. I was trying to make him feel more comfortable, maybe not keep me on such a short leash. I had the transmitter pen in my pocket. Ranger would wonder why I was at the salvage yard. He'd call Morelli. Morelli or Ranger would discover the car. If I stalled a little, there was a good chance I might not die a hideous flamethrower death. Plus, Morelli had called the Vic into the station. If I was lucky, the police would also show up. And if I kept thinking like this, I might not pass out and throw up from terror. Just focus, I kept saying to myself. Don't panic. Too late. Inside, there was panic.
A lot of it.
Where is this salvage yard? Pediak wanted to know.
It's at the far end of Stark Street. Rizzoli Salvage. We all piled into a black Beamer. Probably not the same one that was in my parking lot because this one had four doors. Dave's partner and Pediak were in front, and I was in back with Dave. The flamethrower was in the trunk. Dave didn't look happy to be next to me.
So how's it going? I said to Dave.
Shut up, Dave said.
What's with the knee brace?
You fucking ran over me with your fucking car.
Nothing personal, I said to him.
Yeah, Dave said, and it's not gonna be personal when we barbecue you.
The salvage yard was surrounded by 9-foot-high steel mesh fencing. The entrance was gated and locked. I was guessing this was necessary because so many people wanted to steal cars that were squashed until they were only 2 feet high and had no working parts. The Beamer pulled up to the gate and stopped.
How do we get in? Pediak asked.
I don't know, I said to him. I've never tried to get into a salvage yard before.
Rudy, Pediak said to Dave's partner, take a look.
Dave's partner was named Rudy. Grade school must have been hell with a name like that.
Rudy got out and looked through the gate to the other side.
Hey, he yelled.
He turned back to us and shrugged.
Don't see anyone.
It's pretty big, I said. Maybe there's another entrance.
Rudy got back behind the wheel and drove down Stark. He followed a side road that curved around the salvage yard and did a complete loop. We didn't see any other entrances.
This is perplexing, Pediak said.
Maybe you don't need the key, I said.
I knew he needed the key. He'd gotten the codes off Dickie, and now he needed the key to electronically transfer the $40 million. If he went to Holland to make a personal pickup, he couldn't pass the retinal and hand scan.
Are you sure the key is in there?
He asked. Yep, this is where they took the car.
Can you climb the fence?
Pediak asked Rudy.
Yeah, but there's 3 feet of razor wire at the top. I'll get torn to shreds. I'll never get over the razor wire.
Go back and try the gate. Maybe it's open. Maybe there's a call box.
Rudy went back and rattled the gate and looked around. He returned to the car.
I don't see anything. It's locked up tight with a padlock. I could get in if I had bolt cutters.
Home Depot, I said.
Pediak cut his eyes to me.
You know where there's a Home Depot?
35 minutes later, we were in the Home Depot parking lot, and I was imagining an elaborate rescue scenario. Ranger had tracked us down at Home Depot, and he was organizing an army to storm the salvage yard once we returned to break in with our newly purchased bolt cutters. Pediak and Dave and I were in the car waiting for Rudy. No one was saying anything. Finally, Rudy appeared, striding to the car. No bolt cutters.
Now what? Pediak said.
They didn't have any bolt cutters, Rudy told him, angling himself behind the wheel.
I know where there's a Lowe's, I said.
20 minutes later, we were at Lowe's. I was loving this. More setup time for Ranger and Morelli. Probably the whole police department and the National Guard were at the salvage yard by now. Rudy ran into Lowe's and 15 minutes later came out. No bolt cutters.
I'm losing patience, Pediak said. Go back to the salvage yard.
We were now 40 minutes away from the salvage yard, and I was thinking it would be good if we could resolve this hostage thing soon, because before long I was going to need a bathroom. I'd had a lot of coffee with the donuts. I concentrated on sending Rudy mental messages. Drive faster. Drive faster. Unfortunately, Rudy was having none of it. Rudy wasn't taking a chance on getting stopped by a cop. Rudy was obeying all the rules. After what seemed like hours, we eased up to the salvage yard gate. Still locked. Still no one in sight.
Ram it,
Pediak said.
Excuse me?
Rudy said.
Ram the fucker,
Pediak said.
Back up and floor it and ram the gate open.
It's pretty sturdy, Rudy said.
Dave was stoic beside me, but I could smell him sweating. Dave was nervous.
Maybe we should all get out and let Rudy ram the gate by himself, I said. Then we can walk in if it works.
We're in this together, Pediak said. Rudy, ram the gate.
Rudy backed up and idled for a moment. We all sucked in air and held our breath. And Rudy floored it and rammed the gate. Bang! The gate flew off its hinges, and the front seat airbags exploded. Dave hadn't been buckled in and was thrown forward, hitting the front seat with a good, solid thud. Rudy and Pediak were fighting the airbags. I unbuckled my seatbelt, opened my door, and took off. I ran into the salvage yard where I imagined the Marines were waiting. I didn't see any Marines, so I ran as far and as fast as I could. I passed the crusher machine and took the stairs to a grid of catwalks that led to what looked like a boxcar on stilts. I forced the door and went inside and locked the door behind me. I was in the control room for the crusher machine. I looked out, and I could see Pediak and Dave and Rudy walking my way. Pediak was holding the flamethrower, and Rudy and Dave had guns drawn. My heart was beating so hard it was knocking against my ribcage. No one was here. There weren't even distant sirens. Somehow, the system didn't work. The pen wasn't sending a signal. Someone was asleep at the switch at range, man. Whatever. I was on my own. I frantically looked for a phone, but I was in the throes of blind fear and I wasn't seeing much of anything. I was trapped in a box. No way to escape. It was only a matter of time. They were on the stairs, Pediak first, then Rudy and Dave bringing up the rear. I was pushing buttons and flipping switches, looking for something that would make noise, call the fire department, jettison me out of harm's way. I was so scared my nose was running and my eyes were brimming with tears. It was the flamethrower. I'd seen its work. I could still recall the smell of burned flesh. I could see the horrible, charred cadavers. Pediak was on a catwalk maybe 30 feet off the ground and level with my boxcar control room. I hit a red button, and the hydraulics began moving the crusher walls below me. Rudy and Dave were on the stairs approaching the catwalk, and they stopped dead in their tracks. But Pediak was relentless in his mission. I could see him coming. He reached the control room door and tried the knob. The lock held. He stepped back and gave it a blast from the flamethrower. Nothing. It was a steel fire door. For that matter, the entire control room was steel. I was looking at Pediak through a small window in the door, and I could see the rage in his face. He leveled the flamethrower at me and pumped it. Flames shot toward me, flattened on the steel door, and curled back. Black smoke clouded the window. The door wasn't sealed tight, and heat and smoke crept into the room. I stepped back and looked out the large window facing the crusher. Dave and Rudy were off the stairs and on the ground, running to the salvage yard entrance. I couldn't see Pediak. He wasn't on the stairs. I went back to the door. Smoke was no longer seeping in. There was no more heat. I squinted through the sooty pane of glass. I didn't see Pediak. I went back to the window over the crusher and saw him. He'd inadvertently set himself on fire, and in his confusion and horror, he'd fallen off the catwalk into the crusher. I hit the red button, and the crusher stopped. Not that it mattered. Pediak was clearly dead, and I suspected the crusher would have stopped before it compacted him. It was designed for cars and not maniacs. I took a moment to get myself under control, and then I looked for a phone again. I found the phone and called Morelli. "I'm in the salvage yard," I told him.
"I thought you were doing laundry," he said.
"Just come get me, okay?"
"Where's the car?"
"Forget the car. Find some other way to get here."
Then I called Ranger.
"Where the heck are you?" I asked him.
"I'm at range, man. What are you doing at your mother's?"
"I'm not at my mother's. I'm at the salvage yard."
I glanced down. I was wearing Morelli's sweats. The pen was in my jeans pocket, and the jeans were getting washed. Good thing I was so dumb. If I thought I was kidnapped without the pen, I would have died of fright an hour ago.
"Babe," Ranger said.
"You'll want to see this," I told him.
I called Connie.
"I'm at your cousin Manny's salvage yard," I told her. "Where is everybody? The gate was locked and no one's here."
"Manny's mother-in-law died. They had the funeral today. I didn't go. I only knew her in passing."
"The short version is that Roland Pediak set himself on fire and fell into your cousin's squashing machine."
"I thought your cousin would want to know."
"And also, I'm looking for my Crown Vic. It's somewhere in the salvage yard."
There was a stool in the control room where the operator sat when he was working the compactor.
I sat on the stool and looked out the window, anxious for someone to come rescue me. I didn't want to leave the safety of the little room until Morelli or Ranger was at my door. I avoided looking down into the squashing machine. I didn't want to see Roland Pediak.
I sat there for 10 minutes, and everyone arrived at once. Morelli and Dickie, Ranger, Connie and Lula, and Connie's cousin, Manny.
And Joyce and Smullen's girlfriend. I couldn't remember her name. I called Morelli's cell.
"I'm in the control room by the squasher machine," I said. "I'm not coming out until someone comes up here to get me."
Everyone looked up at me, and I waved down to them and wiped my nose on my sleeve. Morelli took the stairs two at a time and crossed the grate to get to me. I opened the door and almost collapsed. My teeth were chattering, and my legs were rubber.
I was afraid I'd fall off the catwalk if I didn't have someone to hang on to, I told Morelli.
Morelli wrapped an arm around me and peered into the compactor at what was left of Pediac.
That's not good.
It's Pediac.
Are you okay?
So far as I can tell.
And I went down to one knee.
Whoops, I said. Guess I'm a little wobbly.
Ranger was on the catwalk, too, and between Ranger and Morelli, they were able to get me down the stairs.
What the heck's going on here?
Lula wanted to know when I set my feet on the ground.
Nobody tells me anything.
Dickie was still in the hooded sweatshirt, standing to one side, ogling Joyce and Smullen's girlfriend.
Hey, sex monkey,
Dickie said to Joyce.
Do you have it? Joyce said.
What?
You know, it.
Do you mean the $40 million? Nope, government's gonna confiscate it.
You are such a turd, Joyce said. I can't believe I wasted my time with you. How could you have lost that money?
It was all Stephanie's fault, Dickie said.
Asshole, Joyce said,
and she turned on her heel and stormed off with Smullen's girlfriend matching her stride for stride. Morelli called the dispatcher and reported the death and gave a description for Dave and Rudy.
I forgot to take the pen, I told Ranger.
Sometimes it's better to be lucky than good, Ranger said.
You were right about the drugs and guns and money laundering, I told Ranger.
The law firm was stealing guns and trading them for drugs, and then selling the drugs. Then they billed the drug dealers for legal services and washed the money through a legitimate business, Dickie's law firm. Dickie found out, cleaned out the firm's bank account, and transferred the money to his own account. The key to Dickie's account was in the clock.
Tootsie's clock? Lula asked. What are the chances?
I forgot about the clock and left it in the Crown Vic's trunk. The Vic broke down and it got towed here.
When was this?
Connie's cousin Manny asked. Last week. It was an old cop car with pig written on the side, and it had a couple bullet holes in it, and rodent fur on the inside, I told him.
I know just where that is, Manny said. I remember it coming in. Couple SWAT guys, right?
Right.
Ranger's cell phone buzzed, and he took a short call.
I'm heading out, he said to Morelli. She's on your watch. Next week, she's mine.
I was pretty sure he was kidding, but then maybe not.
Come on, Manny said. I'll take you to the Vic.
There were mountains of wheel covers and acres of scrap metal stacked together like lasagna in the salvage yard. We wound through a maze of cars in various stages of mutilation, and finally Manny stopped at a 7-foot-tall block of multicolored metal and pointed about a third of the way up.
See that burgundy layer? That's the Vic.
It was 12 inches thick. We retraced our steps and watched the emergency vehicles pour into the salvage yard. EMS trucks, fire trucks, cop cars. A couple uniforms secured the area around the compactor with tape, and the medical examiner and a crime scene photographer climbed the stairs to the catwalk. Marty Goebel followed.
This is going to take a while to sort out, Morelli said to me. What would you like to do? I can have someone take you to your mother's or to my house.
I didn't want to do either of those things. I was still rattled, and I wanted to be near Morelli. I'd rather stay here, I said. I'll find a place to hang out until you're done, and we can go home together.
It was dark when we rolled into Morelli's house. We'd stopped for a takeout pizza, and we'd picked up the laundry. I was still in Morelli's sweats, and he was still commando in his recycled jeans. I clipped Bob to the long leash in the backyard, and Morelli and I leaned against the kitchen counter and ate pizza.
This has been a very strange day, I said.
Yeah. But it's over, and Dickie is out of my house.
Morelli helped himself to another piece of pizza.
Why on earth did you marry him?
In the beginning, before we were married, he was charming. He was probably fooling around, but I didn't see it. I was impressed with the law degree. I thought it showed intelligence and ambition. My parents loved him. They were ecstatic I wasn't marrying you.
Those were my wild oats sowing days.
Dickie looked like a saint compared to you.
Bob scratched at the door, and we let him in and gave him some Bob food and a couple pieces of pizza.
What do you suppose will happen to Dickie? I asked Morelli.
There's the irony. Dickie could end up being a very rich guy. As far as I can tell, he's guilty of being stupid and devious, but I'm not sure he ever got around to committing a crime.
What about the drug sales?
Word at the station is that the books were kept clean. Everyone knows the firm's dirty, but no one's been able to prove anything. Now that Pediak, Smullen, and Gorvitch are dead, Dickie might end up being the sole owner of the real estate and the $40 million. At the very least, he'll keep his fourth. I guess that's the bad news. But the good news is, Joyce blew Dickie off big time at the salvage yard. At least Joyce won't see any of the money.
I hate to see Dickie get that money. It's so wrong.
Justice has a way of prevailing, Morelli said. Dickie hasn't got the money yet.
I fed Bob the last chunk of my pizza. I'm stuffed. I want to take a hot shower and get into some clean clothes.
Morelli locked the back door and tucked the laundry basket under his arm.
I have a better idea. Let's take a hot shower and get into no clothes.
He looked at the neatly folded clothes in the basket.
Although I am looking forward to test driving my underwear. Your mother ironed everything. My boxers have a crease.
And somewhere under those boxers, I had a single pair of little black panties embroidered with Ranger's name that had all the potential of the toaster bomb. You can test drive them tomorrow, I said to Morelli. I like the no clothes idea for tonight.
We hope you've enjoyed Lean Mean 13, an audio renaissance audiobook from St. Martin's Press. This program was produced and directed by Laura Wilson. Text copyright 2007 by Ivanovich Inc. Production copyright 2007 by Audio Renaissance, a division of Holtspring Publishers, LLC. All rights reserved.
Hi, this is Laura Wilson, executive producer at Audio Renaissance, and I'm here with Janet Ivanovich. Janet, do you know how a story is going to end when you first sit down to write?
Yes, I always know the ending. I know the beginning and I know the ending. I know a few points in between. When I start a book, I do something that is very similar to what a director would do when he starts a movie. I do a storyboard for myself so that if you took it off the storyboard, the picture board, what you would have would really be a timeline of action. And with several active points in the plot line, in the major plot line of the story, my stories always have a couple plot lines. There's the romance plot line in the story, and then there's the action plot line in the story, and they kind of weave back and forth in between each other. But I always know how it's going to end, and usually I have a pretty good idea of where I'm going to go in the next book in the series.
When you're creating characters, when you're writing dialogue, do you hear the voice of the characters in your head?
Yes, the voice is very strong to me. When I'm writing, it really is a movie in front of me. And I learned how to write dialogue by doing acting on stage. I had no English background. And when I decided that I wanted to write, I had absolutely no skills. But I had this very good friend, Susan Kerner, who was working at a local playhouse and giving some acting lessons. And I took some acting with her and had an opportunity to get up on the stage and do improv. And this is how I actually learned how to write dialogue, how I learned how to hear people talking in my head. And I still use this. And when I sit down to write, it's in front of me. It's a very active process for me. I hear them. I see them moving around just as you would see them moving in a movie.
Lorelei King is, of course, Stephanie Plum for all of us, and she's been narrating your books for a long time. What attracts you to Lorelei's voice and Lorelei's interpretation?
Well, she started reading my British books originally, and I liked her so much, I asked my American publishers if they would use her as well. I like her because she doesn't really read with a very strong accent. She doesn't try to make the characters, you know, a real Jersey girl. I think she creates a character that everyone can understand and everyone can identify with. Each of the characters has a little bit different inflection so that we really do know when the character changes. But it's not so dramatic that the words are difficult to understand, and it's not so dramatic that you can't create the character in your head. I think that it's very important that the reader and the listener has an opportunity to create some of the character themselves. I don't like a reader who is so strong that the person listening doesn't have the opportunity to add something. I would absolutely love to read my own audiobooks. There are two problems there. The first problem is that I'm not sure I have time. And the second problem is that I probably would be really lousy at it. I mean, this is a hard job. You know, it's one thing to stand up on stage and to be a big ham and to entertain. I mean, you're just talking directly to people. It's no different from going out to dinner for me. But sitting there and reading an audiobook, I mean, what an awesome responsibility this is to be able to be true to several characters. I'm a performer, but I'm not an actor.
I'm sure you've been asked this before, but are a lot of your experiences incorporated into the books? Is a lot of Stephanie's life coming from your life?
Yeah, there are a lot of things that are, I've given all of my embarrassing moments over to my books. I mean, sooner or later, everything gets out there in the printed word. I had an instance where Stephanie, it was just a little tiny snippet, you know, as they usually are, where Stephanie said at one point that she was a baton twirler and she had thrown her baton back into the band during the national anthem. And I actually did that in high school. Big Blue, the car that Stephanie drives, the 53 Buick, I learned how to drive on that car. That car was the bane of my existence. This was, you know, this total embarrassing moment that wouldn't go away for years and years because my dad loved that car. So there are a lot of things. Stephanie thinks the same way that I do. She's younger, she's braver, she's slimmer than I am. But we think alike, and we have a lot of the same history.
Tell me a bit about your bookstore events. What are they like?
My bookstore events are completely insane. When I first started doing book tour, I would go into stores and I would sit at this little card table and nobody would come. I mean, I had lots of book signings where not one single person arrived and bought a book. And people would walk by and ask you where the ladies' room was. You know, that was a big event. Somebody actually spoke to you. And then I got a few more people and, you know, little by little, my fan base increased. It wasn't until the website really took off and I started to get a large number of people subscribing to my newsletter. We put out a paper copy of a newsletter twice a year. And it's free and we send it all over the world. And when that happened, when we started posting my book signings on the website and started advertising them in the newsletter, all of a sudden, people were able to find me. They knew where I was. So we started having these huge numbers of people coming out to the events. And we started realizing that they were driving large distances. People would get into vans, you know, 5-6 people would get into a van and drive for 4 or 5 hours to get to see me at a book signing. People were actually planning vacations and flying in to be able to participate in a book signing. When that happened, we realized that we had more of a responsibility to these people than just having me sit behind a desk. We felt like we needed to entertain them. We needed to make sure that they had a good time. So we started designating a couple cities and putting on stage shows or making them into parties with, you know, cheesecake and balloons and live bands or DJs, and the Trenton Cops would show up. And so I average about 2,000 people to a signing now. The signings are somewhere between 700 to 3,000-4,000 people, and probably they average about two. My signings will go anywhere from 5 to 7 hours without me ever getting out of the chair. And most of those people will have several books to sign. We've had to limit the books that people bring. And they bring audio books to be signed too. You know, we have special pens and we rip open the plastic so that I can sign the outside of the package. And we actually have a lot of these coming through at the signings. And the truth is I've worn my thumb down. I have arthritis in the thumb on my signing hand. I've literally worn the joint away so that I have to get cortisone shots and wear a brace when I sign. And we've had to limit the signings to just the new book that's coming out because I just can't sign all of my backlist anymore. But the people are amazing. I mean, they're there for a good time. They're happy. They all have their cameras. They have their books, their whole families that come, grandmothers and kids in junior high. There's a very wide range of readership with the with all of the books, with the full series and with the Plum books. young people will get hold of them, and it'll go right through a junior high, and seniors love them. They love Grandma Mazur and everybody in between. And I have an increasing readership of men.
I think this is a question everybody has for writers. Who are the writers that have influenced you?
The writers that actually have influenced me most have probably been writers from my childhood. You know, when I was a kid, I read all the Walter Farley books. I wanted to be a horse when I grew up. And then I read a lot of comic books. And I was a big Uncle Scrooge and Donald Duck fan. I love Carl Barks. Carl Barks, I think, is genius. And the Uncle Scrooge and Donald Duck comic books were adventure stories. They were always going off to the Yukon. You know, Scrooge and Donald would pack off to the Yukon to try to find gold, and they'd find the gold, and they'd, you know, encounter some bad guys en route, but they would succeed, and they'd bring the gold back and change it into quarters and put it in the big vault in Duckburg, and then Uncle Scrooge would push it around with his bulldozer. And so, you know, like, how fun is this? I mean, this I wanted to be Uncle Scrooge when I grew up. This is, and I think this is what I'm doing. I think I'm writing adventure stories that were not too far removed from Uncle Scrooge and Donald Duck going off to the Klondike.
I know you spend a lot of time writing, but what do you do when you're not writing?
You know, this is an embarrassing question to answer because I'm almost never not writing. I like to walk. I'm nosy. I love shopping. I love to go to a shopping center and walk around and watch the people. And of course, you know, I mean, I'm from Jersey. I'm a shopper. What can I say? I like having money, and I like spending money. But I also like the people. I like walking my dog and snooping, you know, in people's front yards and front porches when I walk the dog. I like music. I have terrible taste in music. I shouldn't admit this. I like disco. What can I say? John Travolta, I'm there. I think he should be Joe Morelli. I'm not sure he'd be right for the part, but, you know, wouldn't you love to dance with him when the movie was made?
How much research did you have to do in order to create Stephanie and her whole world of bounty hunters and FTAs, her failures to appear, and the whole Berg?
I did a lot of research in the beginning. Before I even started the series, I went around with some bounty hunters. I was living in Northern Virginia, and I knew nothing about this. I actually got the idea from a movie, from Midnight Run, with Charles Grodin and Robert De Niro. And I loved the idea that there actually were bounty hunters out there and that they had all of this personal freedom. They were kind of rogue guys. You know, maybe they sort of walked that line between what was the law and what wasn't. So I called up some bail bondsmen, looked them up in the Yellow Pages, called up some bail bondsmen, and they put me in touch with some bounty hunters. And I went and hung out with these guys and tried to figure out how they caught people, who they were, how much money they made, how successful they were, what kind of equipment they carried, what their lives were like. And then I did some other things. I had never held a gun before. I don't come from a hunting family. I have no gun culture. But I knew that my heroine would have to use a gun. So I went out and learned how to shoot, tried to figure out what kind of a gun I would feel comfortable with. One of the reasons Stephanie is modeled so much after me is because it gives me a point of reference. You know, I'm very average. Stephanie is very average. We all kind of came up through this bounty hunter business together. And I also went to the Trenton Police Department. I knew I wanted to set it in Trenton. I'm a Jersey girl. I wanted to take this series back to Jersey. So I went to the Trenton Police Department. They were very nice to me. They assigned me to a couple guys. And that's how I started my history with the Trenton cops, started riding around with them, trying to figure out who they were, what they did, sort of the same process that I went through with the bounty hunters.
This is a game I've played with Lorelei King when I was in the studio with her. We're always looking to see who we would cast to play Ranger and Morelli and Stephanie. So I'm wondering, who would you like to see cast in those roles?
Casting is a really tricky question. I've created these people, and they have a certain look in my head that doesn't necessarily correspond to anybody out there. And then the other problem with this is that I keep casting it, but, you know, as the movie isn't made and the series progresses, actresses and actors kind of move on. I think right now I would love to see someone like Sandra Bullock come on as Stephanie. I think she has great comic timing. She certainly has the look. She has great chemistry up there. I've never been able to find anybody that I really thought was the perfect Joe Morelli in my mind. I think Ranger is the rock, you know, because the people in the Plum series were all wrestling fans. You know, Grandma Mazur loves seeing guys in little spandex panties. And so I think The Rock would be super as Ranger. He has that, you know, all that muscle, and he does that eyebrow thing, right? Couldn't you just see Ranger doing that eyebrow thing that The Rock does?
Is there a real Joe Morelli, and is there a real Ranger?
No, sad to say. I would love to find a real Joe Morelli and a Ranger, and if I find any of them, you'll be the first to know. We'll, you know, put their phone numbers up on the internet. They are strictly fantasy characters. They come out of my background as a romance writer. I think that if a movie is made, and TriStar has bought the Plum series, they bought it years and years ago, and it's been active pre-production. They keep writing scripts, have never been able to find exactly the perfect combination. I think it will be very interesting if they do, and they cast these characters, and then, you know, interesting to see if they really do become Joe and Ranger, and if forever and ever, then, you know, they're stuck in my mind as those people. Then Joe and Ranger really would be real.
I know you've traveled a lot for the books and for your research for the books. Do you have a favorite experience from those travels and from that research?
I'm not sure that I have a favorite experience. Of course, I did enjoy researching the books in Vegas because, you know, because I love Vegas. I did have one fun experience when I was hanging out with the bounty hunters. I was out in Washington, D.C. one time with a guy, and we were at a little pastry shop, and it was noon hour, so the pastry shop was filled, all these little tables. And I was sitting there with this big, bad bounty hunter who was, you know, of course, dressed all in black, you know, with the black cowboy boots and the black leather jacket, and, you know, because he was out with a writer, and he had to be, you know, the bounty hunter. And we were sitting there, and he went to reach for, I forget what it was, the salt, a ketchup bottle, I don't know, but his coat swung open, and he clearly had a gun, you know, under his jacket. It was a big gun. And you could hear about seven tables and chairs just scrape back, you know. And it was about 5 minutes later, we're the only people sitting in that little pastry shop. Everybody else just kind of took off and left. And of course, it was illegal. I mean, we were in D.C., and he was carrying concealed without a permit. And he was kind of a bad-looking guy. I mean, I have to admit, he was a big guy. He was dressed in black. He had black cowboy boots. He had, you know, he had the whole deal. And he had a gun and just scared the heck out of all the people in that poor little pastry shop.
I think Stephanie comes across to readers and listeners as a regular person, someone they can really relate to. Do you think her regularness is part of her appeal for your fans?
I think it's part of the reason. I think people like her. They admire her. Sometimes, you know, people feel like if Stephanie can get through the day, so can they, because Stephanie isn't perfect. She kind of bumbles her way through. But she has tenacity. She sticks with it. She doesn't get discouraged. She picks herself up, and she gets on with the job. I think that another reason why people like the series is just because it's very positive. And I think we have a lot of negative things out there. You know, you read the newspaper and it's depressing. And we need something to counterbalance that. And that's the Plum series. This is a happy series. These people are slightly wacky and dysfunctional, but they love each other, and they always come through for each other. They're there. Everything about this series ultimately is a positive experience. There are funny scenes in here. You can laugh out loud with this book. You can giggle. You can laugh out loud. You can smile. People are very grateful for this. They love the fact that they found something that they can laugh at. It's kind of astonishing that people feel like there are so few things out there that make them laugh. And I think they're very grateful for this. I have a lot of letters from people who have lost loved ones. I have a lot of letters from people who are going through illnesses, cancer, recovery, people who take the books into chemo, people who just have fallen into sad times for one reason or another. And they're always very grateful that they found something that makes them smile and that makes them laugh. And they're very grateful that they have these people that they can count on, that they know this is going to be this positive, good-feeling experience. And I think that has a lot to do with the popularity of the series. I think the the characters. And I also think that this is like a soap opera, you know, where you tune in to these lives every year, every day. You can come in and you can see where they're going, how this relationship is developing, what this family is doing next year. Are they going to get married? Are they going to... is there going to be an illness in the family? How many cars is she going to explode? It gets to be a contest after a while. And I think that people love this ability to kind of, you know, be voyeurs into the lives of this community and this family. I think that the community is also very important. When I was writing romance novels, I was living in Northern Virginia. And it was a very transient community. When I grew up as a kid, I grew up in South River, New Jersey, little town, lived in an extended family situation. Everyone sat on their front porch, just like everyone sits on their front porch in the Plum series, in these, in the little houses in the burg. When I grew up and I started moving around, we were following my husband's career, we moved to Virginia, and it was a much more affluent, more transient community. And we all sat on our decks in the back of the house. And I think that this is a very important distinction, because what happens is that the people who sit on their deck in the back of the house become isolated. They are no longer as much a part of the community. And I think that there are a lot of Americans that feel a loss here, that wish that they had that community, that they could be part of this extended family, this extended community. And the Plum series takes people back to that. The Plum series goes back to the way it was when I was a kid, and we were all sitting on the porch, and we knew everybody in town, and we took care of everybody in town. We watched out for every kid on a bike. We watched out for people who were sick. And so I think this is some of the appeal as well.
Do you know if Stephanie's ever inspired any real-life woman bounty hunters?
Yeah, we hear from people from time to time. I always have kind of mixed feelings about this because, of course, you know, I fictionalized the role of the bounty hunter for Stephanie. And it really is a very hard job. It's not a glamorous job. It's not that easy to make money as a bounty hunter. Most people who are very successful bounty hunters are actually bail bondsmen. And a lot of the bail bondsmen in this country are women. Probably about 50% of all bail bonds people are women. And they go out and they do their own apprehensions and are very successful at it.
I have yet another question that I'm sure you're asked all the time, but I am still curious to know the answer. Who will Stephanie end up with?
Oh, let's see. The Simpsons Magic 8 Ball says, life is a cookie.